Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Misfit Faith podcast. This is episode number 23. I'm your host, Jason Stellman. Glad to be with you again. Our number is 949-354-2483. Go straight to voicemail. If you got a question, something you want me to talk about, something I can clarify for you, or if you got an observation or some pushback, anything, give me a call, leave me a voicemail, and I will play it on the air. Real quick, before we jump in, I wanted to point out the fact that just the other day, I went back and completely restructured all of my Patreon tiers and the associated rewards that come with them. And I actually sweetened the pot a bit by taking some of the higher rewards and now assigning them to lower tiers. And so there's basically four tiers. The $1 tier, if you go to patreon.com/JasonStellman to support the work that I do. You'll notice that the $1 tier gives you access to chapters from the book I'm writing. As you know, I'm writing a book called Our Daily Dread. It's a sort of satirical, disruptive daily devotional. And as I complete new entries, I put them on Patreon. That used to be for $5 patrons. Now, $1 patrons get that. And so if you support me to the tune of $1 a month, you can read the book I'm writing as I'm writing it, and you can give me feedback on it, push back anything you want. The next tier is the $5 tier. If you become a patron to the tune of $5 a month, then you get access to video presentations by me of these entries, of these Our Daily Dread entries. That's one of the things I do in the Misfit Faith community, which I'll talk about in a moment, is I do at least once a week, I go in and I do a little live video where I present an entry from my forthcoming book and talk about it a little bit and answer questions if there are any. Well, those videos I'm now uploading to Patreon, and I think there's one of them that's up there now, and all $5 patrons get access to those. Now, the next tier is $10. Did I say there were four? There are five. Five tiers altogether. The next tier is a $10 tier. If you become a patron to the tune of $10 a month, then in addition to the earlier rewards I talked about already, you also get a free 30-minute mentoring session with me. My mentoring sessions are usually an hour, and what I decided to do was to give away free 30-minute sessions with anyone who's a $10 or more patron. And the reason for this is that I do think that mentoring is something that a lot of people need, especially if you're navigating a spiritual identity crisis of some kind or another. I know that the clients that I mentor currently, you know, they've expressed, you know, incredible encouragement and change in them as they've had someone to walk with them through the things they're trying to navigate. And as a way to kind of give people a little bit of insight into my mentoring program, I thought I'd give away a free mentoring call of 30 minutes to any $10 patrons. Obviously, you know, you can't cover a lot of ground in just 30 minutes beyond some encouragement and some practical advice, but it is a way to get a feel for what mentoring might look like if you wanted to do that with me on a regular basis. As you know, the $25 tier, in addition to everything else I've talked about, $25 gets you access membership into the Misfit Faith community, which is a private group on Facebook. I just finished up an hour-long talk with the people in the Misfit Faith community just now. We're going through my book. We're talking about what book to go through next. But we basically have a one-hour-long video chat where I kind of present some ideas from whatever we're going through. People can ask questions and offer feedback, and that's a really great thing to do. I really enjoy it. $25 a month gets you access to that. And then finally, the $30 tier, in addition to everything else I said, you also get access to the Misfit Faith Deluxe audiobook. Speaking of Patreon, I wanted to say thanks to Brian, who upped his pledge this last week, which kind of makes up for the fact that I lost a few patrons in the last week, too. So, you know, one step forward, a couple steps back, but I'm happy with any support and encouragement I get. And I would like to encourage all of you to really, you know, take advantage of, if you're, especially if you're already a $10 or more patron, take advantage of that free mentoring session. And if you are thinking about mentoring, maybe become a patron for 10 bucks, get that free call, and decide if you want to pull the trigger after that. I know that it's helped a lot of people, and I really get a kick out of drawing from my own experiences, both successes and failures, and the kind of things I've had to deal with in my own personal spiritual journey, and using those to encourage other people. And so if mentoring is something that you think would be helpful for you, go to my website, jasonstellman.com/mentoring, and find out more. All right, on we go. As you know, I've been doing a series here on the Misfit Faith podcast called Faith Getting Woke. And what that is we're exploring issues that I think the church, the American church as a whole, sort of needs to address, needs to rethink its position on, if they want to speak meaningfully into the lives of post-Christian people in a post-Christian culture that we live in. We've talked about the issue of power. We talked about the issue last week of evil, and what to do about the problem of evil and the existence of God. We talked a couple weeks ago about a fear of the body and a fear of the material world. And I've argued that until and unless the church rethinks its posture, then it's going to have a hard time reaching people in a culture that we are in now, where Christianity is no longer just assumed, but it has to be argued for and defended. Well, this week, I want to turn our attention to LGBT issues. Now, I would argue that this is perhaps one of the biggest issues that the church is facing today, and I think one of the biggest impediments to people in the culture taking the faith seriously, whether they are gay or straight, is the church's position on LGBT issues, the queer community in general. You know, the traditional position, and I'm sure you know this, is that being gay is a choice that people make, and it's a choice to sin. By engaging in behavior that is disordered, that is harmful, and that is icky. And, you know, that ick factor plays a huge role in the way many conservative evangelical people respond to gay people. If someone is living a gay lifestyle, so this position says, he or she is simply outside of the sphere of divine favor and subject to an eternal sentence to hell. Now, there are several problems with this, and we don't have time to get into all of them today. But one of the problems with this kind of traditional position is that from a gay person's perspective, this seems a bit arbitrary. Now, I want you to do your best to follow me here. I'm not gay, but I have tried to see the message and to hear the message of the church through the ears and to see it through the eyes of a gay person as best as I'm able to. I want you to try to do that as well, as I kind of walk you through one of the reasons why I consider the traditional position to be extremely problematic. This seems arbitrary to a gay person. You know, why can a man and a woman engage in the exact same kinds of sexual activities as the ones that some gay people engage in, and in the case of the man and the woman, it's fine? Right? Why is that? Why are we being singled out as being, you know, disordered and perverted when the things that some of us want to do are no different physiologically from the things that a man and a woman apparently are perfectly free to engage in with one another? What's the deal? Well, the answer, you know, from some conservative people might be that, well, if the man and the woman are married, then it's okay for them. But then, of course, the next question will be, well, can gay people get married then? So it's okay. And, you know, in most cases, the answer to that is no, you can't get married because marriage is between a man and a woman, according to the Bible. And so the very same acts that a married couple can do, some of them, gay people want to do. Married people can do them, and it's okay because they're married. Gay people can't do them because they're not married. And sex is for marriage. Well, can we get married? No, you can't, because marriage is not for you. So you can see, I hope, how bigoted and seemingly random and arbitrary this whole setup really is. You know, so why is something like oral sex, in which the man is on the receiving end of it, why is it okay if the giver is a female, but not when the giver is a male? And I hope I'm not, you know, being too explicit here and ruffling any feathers or disturbing your you know, nice sense of well-being. This is a grown-up show, so we're going to talk about real grown-up issues. When a man is receiving oral sex, why is it okay if the person giving it is a female, but not okay if the person is a male? There's literally no difference physically and physiologically in what is happening in both of those two circumstances. Right? The only conclusion a person can reach from this is that the Bible is randomly singling out this particular issue and condemning it for no discernible reason. Now, interestingly enough, the Catholic Church escapes the charge of bigotry. It escapes the charge that it's kind of singling out at random gay people and the stuff they like to do in an unfair, kind of arbitrary, capricious way. The Catholic Church really does escape that charge, but not in a way anyone wants to hear, right? You know, because for the Catholic, there is an actually principled reason why some of these activities are prohibited. It's not an ad hoc or arbitrary reason, but a principled one that's consistent. And of course, you probably know what that reason is. The reason is that in the Catholic mindset, all sexual activity that is not potentially procreative is wrong. And so masturbation is wrong. And the same is true of oral and anal sex to completion. These things are wrong, not just when they're engaged in by one particular segment of society, one particular community, like the queer community, for example. No, it's wrong for everybody, right? If it's sexual activity that's not potentially procreative, it is considered by the Catholic Church wrong, regardless of who you're doing it with, okay? So while the Catholic Church, you know, avoids singling out the gay stuff in an arbitrary way, and they do it by condemning all non-procreative sexual activity, it also, you have to admit, the Catholic Church reduces sex to a mere means to an end, right? Namely, procreation, rather than seeing sex as a worthwhile thing to do for its own sake. You know, for example, because it's really fun and feels really good. But you see, getting back to LGBT folks, whether they are being excluded from the Jesus Club out of bigotry or by principle, they're still being excluded, and they know it. Now, in our day, you know, where most people have come around on the issue of same-sex attraction and have finally realized and admitted that, you know, it's not something that people simply choose, because why would you? You know, why would you choose something that you know is going to make your life a living hell? But most people recognize that this is something that you're born with, an attraction to the same sex, and something you cannot change about yourself. Well, in the day that we live in which people have realized this, it's time for the church to reckon with this community, because they're not going anywhere. You can't ignore them. You know, I was talking to a mentoring client just the other day, and he was expressing to me his frustration with his current church. And you know, despite the fact that his church is starting to, you know, say about itself that we want to be a place where the community can come and feel safe and welcomed, despite, you know, wanting to do that, you know, they're not pulling the trigger and following through, and they're still isolating and alienating people. And I would suggest, and I suggested to him, that as long as a church takes the position that gay people either need to cut it out and abstain for the rest of their lives or go through some conversion therapy, that church will never be looked upon by the broader community, gay or straight, as a place that welcomes them the way they think Jesus ought to do. Now, one last observation. I brought this up before, but John chapter 8, the famous story in the first 11 or so verses, where Jesus meets the woman who is caught in the act of adultery. He's minding his own business. The religious establishment people come with this woman who they say was caught in the act of adultery. Moses in the law says that such should be stoned. What say you? And if you know the story, Jesus ignores them, bends down, kind of writes in the dirt with his finger for a while until eventually everyone leaves, except just the woman is standing there. And Jesus says, "Where are your accusers? Has no man condemned you?" And she says, "No one." And he goes, "Well, then neither do I condemn you." Now, if we treat the New Testament not as a kind of frozen in time snapshot of a fixed morality, but instead, if we understand the New Testament to be sowing ethical seeds whose blossoming may not happen for a while. In other words, if we see the ethical ideas in the New Testament not as, written in stone, morality forever and all time, but rather as a trajectory that may not produce its fruit immediately. Like, for example, I think you can make a case that slavery is wrong from the New Testament, but it took like 1700 years for people to really kind of put it into practice. The same is true of women's issues. If we treat the New Testament not as this frozen in time snapshot of a fixed morality, but instead in the way I've just suggested, then a passage like this in John 8, where Jesus chose to set aside Moses' law and extend mercy and acceptance to this adulterous woman, could indicate the way forward. Because you see, if Jesus had pulled the Moses trigger and said, "Stone her," he may have given so-called justice its due, but he would have lost his following of misfits and sinners. Now, speaking of misfits and sinners, my guest on the show, the guy I want to get on the phone right now to talk to us about this, is somebody you've probably heard of. If you've not heard of him, you've certainly heard of his parents. Jay Baker is the son of Jim Baker and Tammy Faye Baker. And if you grew up in the 80s at all, you were aware of Jim and Tammy Faye, of their fame in the Pentecostal movement. And Jay, I've known him for a couple years. He was a guest on Drunk Ex-Pastors with Christian and me some time back. He is a pastor in his own right. He is a writer. And he is one of the earliest public figures who took an affirming stance toward the queer community. Jay, some 10, 15 years ago, decided that his church was going to be an affirming church and decided that they are no longer going to exclude LGBTQ folks from their ranks, from all of the privileges of membership in their church. He took a huge, massive hit. He lost a lot of his support. He lost a lot of his speaking engagements. He lost a lot of his congregation. He paid a major price for this stance. And this is back before it was really accepted or progressive or cool to do. He did it out of principle. And Jay's agreed to chat with us a little bit about that and about about the effects of that decision he made that he's still feeling. And so hang on, let me get Jay on the phone to chat with us.
Hello.
Hey, I'm looking for Jay Baker.
This is him.
Hey, man. Appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule to chat with us today.
No problem.
So we're talking about LGBT issues and in the larger context of kind of ways the church might need to rethink some of its positions on various issues in order to kind of be taken seriously and to speak into the lives of people in a meaningful way in this sort of post-Christian culture we're in. Now, you, of course, grew up with pretty famous parents, and I'm curious, what are your earliest memories when you were younger about kind of the way LGBT folks were kind of spoken about or treated when you were younger?
Well, it was the early 80s, and AIDS was just, happening. And so that was a big deal, people were dying. Different church people were saying different things. Some people were saying it was a curse from God and all that kind of stuff. But my earliest memories are my mom interviewing a gentleman with AIDS for her show. And my parents always kind of being open to loving people where they were at. So it was kind of, for me, it was an example of loving people. and not being afraid of them. Because at this point, no one knew how you got AIDS exactly, and people were very fearful of it. So my parents seemed to be more open to loving people, meeting them where they were at, and not being afraid of it. So, you know, that was my first memories.
Yeah, your mom really seemed to exude both a love for the other and also kind of a fearlessness, right? When it comes to the sort of different people that she would kind of come in contact with and befriend and just love unconditionally.
Yeah, she really believed, you know, in the idea of the two greatest commandments. So love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. And so she really always felt it was about love. And love seemed to be the trump card. So, yeah, she was fearless.
So for you, as you kind of grew up and became an adult and started to have a platform of your own and thoughts of your own, despite, you know, the example that was set for you by your parents and your mom especially, you did break with the sort of broader evangelical tradition in a pretty public way. I don't know if it was about 10 years ago or a little bit longer ago, but talk a little bit about that. You know, what did you do to break with that broader tradition, and what was it that brought about this change of mind for you?
Well, like most people, having a lot of LGBTQ friends was important and a big influence on me. And at the time, the Bible, studying the Bible was also big, you know. So I just kept running into this, like, this doesn't add up, you know. Why are we ostracizing our gay brothers and sisters? And so I just started studying, because I'm not saying I was a literalist, but I was more dependent on the Bible at the time. And I wanted to see if it was there. And what I found was that there was a lot of things about worshiping to other gods and sacrifices and wasting of seed and things like that. So I found that, you know, being LGBTQ as we understood it wasn't in the Bible. So for me, it became a big conviction to you know, and I had a lot of friends too who helped me through this, but it became a conviction that it wasn't a sin. So, man, it's been 10, 11, 12, maybe 13, 14 years ago that I just decided that, you know, this is a no-brainer. This isn't a sin. And I decided to say that, and it was quite earth-shattering for me because, you know, the church lost a lot of its support, and we had a really hard time recovering from it, from taking that stance. But it was the right thing to do, you know. And so that was kind of what happened at that time, was just studying the Bible, talking to people, and the need to love, you know, wanting to love.
Yeah, I remember you sharing with me before, because we've had you on Drunk Ex-Pastors, and you even said all of your speaking engagements were canceled. You lost the bulk of your support, because this is, I mean, what we're talking about now is not all that controversial now, but when you were talking about this stuff, you were one of the first people to kind of
right.
publicly, you know, on such a big platform, make that stance. But you lost your speaking and your gigs and all that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can honestly say it never 100% recovered from it. Still to this day, even though it's not much of an issue anymore, or I mean, I guess it still is an issue. It just depends on where you're at, you know. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and, you know, we're Lutheran heaven right here. So, you know, we got a lot of affirming, open Christians. But we never really completely snapped back from it.
Yeah, that's sort of a bold move, you know. You're, in a sense, you're suffering something, you know, in imitating Christ in that way, suffering at the hands of the people who are supposed to be your people, right? But, you know, speaking of the Bible, you know, I always look at that passage in John 8 about the woman caught in adultery whom the Pharisees are telling Jesus to stone because Moses in the law commands that such should be stoned. What do you say? And Jesus kind of ignores them. And eventually they all leave. And he basically forgives the woman, doesn't condemn her. And I always thought, you know, if we read the Bible as a kind of trajectory, you know, rather than as a snapshot or a frozen in time ethic, but instead we read it, you know, as though it's giving us a trajectory and there are seeds being planted here that might take several centuries or even millennia to be kind of full grown.
Well, that's what it is, right.
I think that speaks to the, that seems to speak to the LGBT thing, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, you're right. I mean, it is a trajectory, and Jesus changed the law. You know, Jesus took out the, you know, Jesus and both Paul took out the violence from the law, you know, and the death and the killing, and said, you know, it's not about that. It's not about sacrifice, you know. I mean, it was revolutionary what Jesus did, and people don't often see that. They want to hold, they feel like they have to hold the whole Bible as inerrant and that it can't contradict itself. But Jesus was contradicting the law because he was changing it. He was saying, you know, you've heard it said this way, but I say this. And it's an evolution. It's a book of evolution.
Yeah, and I think that's what we need to recognize, you know, because if you take the Bible as like this frozen in time ethic book of morality or whatever, then you run into all kinds of problems, like women keep silent in the churches, slaves obey your masters. It seems like we have no problem recognizing the sort of historical contingency of some of those ethical teachings, but why can't we see that as well when it comes to LGBTQ issues?
You know, I can't understand it. You know, I don't know why. I think people are afraid of sexuality. You know, it boggles my mind why people can see certain things as, oh yeah, but you know what? There are Christians who still think that women are supposed to be silent in church. You know, and people did justify slavery using the Bible. So, you know, people read it like a constitution or a law book rather than something that's evolving and changing, and seems to be somewhat to do with human nature. And I think a lot of people who cling to religion often cling to it out of fear and are afraid to change it, you know?
There's definitely that factor, I think. You know, there's a sort of a kind of xenophobia that I think just about everybody wrestles with, you know, like, if you're a 60-year-old man and you go into McDonald's and they're speaking Spanish, you know, or if the billboard on the side of the freeway is in a language that you don't know, there's something I think that in all of us that reacts against the unfamiliar. And, you know, that's why I think, you know, the taking the stance that you have done helps kind of bring awareness to this issue, because a lot of times it's not, I don't think it's necessarily hatred or homophobia as much as it's just a fear of what we don't understand and what we're not used to.
Yeah, the fear of the unknown definitely plays a big part of it, and change, a fear of change.
Absolutely. What would you say, just as we wrap up, you know, if you were given a chance to sort of speak to the conservative evangelical church about this, what would you say, you know, what would you urge upon them if you were given the chance to talk to them about this issue?
Well, I would just say, you know, people say that you'll know us by our fruit, and looking at the fruit of the anti-ex-gay movement or the, you know, LGBT, anti-LGBTQ movement has been nothing but homelessness, suicide, death, people leaving the church. That it just doesn't add up. That there's not peace and patience and kindness and joyfulness, and you know those things aren't there in the fruits of the ex-gay movement. Even if you look at the ex-gay ministries that have had to close down because they, like, it doesn't work, you know, it doesn't happen. It ends up adding more pain and suffering, and it doesn't seem like that's what Christ has called us to do, is add more pain and suffering to people's lives, but to bring grace and freedom and hope and love. So I would encourage them to say, look at the facts, you know, look at what this has done to people's lives, you know, look at the hate that it gives into their lives and the separation and the us and them mentality, and just taking a look at what comes out of it, and that it's something that is poisonous and something that's very harmful and has hurt way too many people, and it's led a path of destruction and pain. And that if we were able to look at that and say, okay, it's time to rethink what we've done, and in a way repent, which just means turning and changing of mind and finding a better way.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to put it, finding a better way. I think of Paul at the end of 1 Corinthians 12, after talking about the gifts of the Spirit, he says, but let me show you a more excellent way. And then, of course, he launches into 1 Corinthians 13, the way of love,
right?
Which, as you even said, talking about your mom, you know, and your dad, it was like, that was kind of what it was supposed to be about, is loving God and loving our neighbor. So, Jay, how can people find you on social media? Is there any way that people can support you? Are you working on anything? How can people engage with what you're doing if they want to find out more about you?
Well, we have a church service every Sunday in Minneapolis at a place called Bryant Lake Bowl at 11 o'clock. They can find me on revolutionchurch.com. All of our services are there for free to listen to. I'm Jay Baker on Facebook and on Instagram and Twitter. I'm more of an Instagram person nowadays. You know, so you can find me those places.
Cool. Well, dude, thank you for chatting with us today. I know you're a busy guy, so appreciate you taking a few moments and kind of sharing your heart with us.
You're welcome.
Hey, good morning, Jason. It's Jonathan from Arkansas. Listened to Drunk Ex-Pastors for a long time. Of course, listened to you. My question today is about love. I grew up in the church, basically Christian school from kindergarten until high school. And the one thing I got out of the Bible is that we're supposed to love people. We're supposed to love our neighbors, treat people how we want to be treated, which sounds easy. But then when you think about it, it's kind of tough to define what exactly love is. My answer came to me actually at a wedding, and the person officiating the wedding described love as the fruit of the Spirit. And of course, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control are some of the other fruits of the Spirit. But he said that those were actually the attributes that make up love instead of being their own separate fruits. So I don't know if that makes sense. Basically, love is the fruit of the Spirit, and everything else in that list is how we show love. I'm kind of curious what you thought of that, and maybe sometime you could expand on it. Anyways, sorry about the rambling, incoherent message, and keep up the good work. Love the shows. Thanks. Bye.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan, for the question. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that the Christian faith is all about love, right? Love of God, love of neighbor. Or you could put it that, you know, it's about loving God by loving your neighbor. And that's just everywhere, as you know, I'm sure. That's everywhere in the New Testament. You know, all the law and the prophets hang on this one word, you know, love. And it summarizes the entire law and the prophets, and it's what it's all about. And it's a good point that, you know, Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit, is love. And then he goes on and talks about joy, peace, understanding, gentleness, kindness, goodness, mercy, all those things, which, of course, you could see are descriptors of what love looks like. And I'd also, you know, draw your attention to 1 Corinthians 13, the famous chapter that you've heard it read at weddings your whole life. You know, love is patient, love is kind, love does not seek its own, all of that. And, of course, I'd say the key to it all is Jesus. What did love look like as exhibited by him? And that's where I think you get into the issue of self-giving and sacrifice. That love is not just a feeling of bubbly emotions that wells up in your heart, you know, when you look at a kitten or a puppy. But love is actually an act of the will that involves a measure of self-giving and sacrifice, a willingness to suffer, even if you don't deserve it. You know, and since we're talking about LGBT issues on this episode, you know, turning it back to that question and applying this issue of love to that, you know, to love them, I need to listen to them when they tell me how they are made to feel by American Christianity, which in their eyes is the guys on my team. I need to listen to them when they tell me how I make them feel. And of course, it's easy in our day and age of social media and you know, the Me Too movement and all of that to immediately go into a posture of defensiveness, of self-defense, you know, and saying, well, I'm not the one who did that. I didn't do that. Not all men or not all straight people, right? But sometimes love dictates that when a group that is marginalized and even oppressed and persecuted, when they are telling me, a straight white man, how my people have made them feel, how they've been victimized by my tribe, then love, at least a Christ-like, sacrificial, self-giving, self-emptying love, might dictate that I just need to let myself be nailed to that cross for the sins of my people, even if I don't deserve it. That's what love does, and that's what love is. So thanks, Jonathan. Great question. All right. Almost out of time, but as usual, I need a minute.
Now it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
Okay, with a few notable exceptions, all songs are too long. You heard me. All songs are too long. I would argue that the majority of songs are like 3 to 4 times longer than they need to be. Usually the structure is something like, you know, verse, chorus, and then some unnecessary musical filler followed by a final chorus. And here's my problem. If I get to the guitar solo part and I know that all that's waiting for me on the back end of this thing is just another chorus, then I get bored and I hit skip. I almost never make it to the end of any song. Now, if there were a final verse after the solo, like let's say it's verse, chorus, guitar solo, and then another verse of all new words followed by a final chorus, then I'm absolutely going to wait for it. I will power through this thing, make it to the end of the 4 minutes. But if it's a song like Clocks or With or Without You, you know, you're looking at like 3 minutes of wasted time as far as I'm concerned. Now, I know what you're thinking, and I'll say it. Some songs are structured so as to be super long, and that's okay. Like Stairway to Heaven is structured in such a way that it's supposed to be like 11 minutes long or however long it is. Paranoid Android by Radiohead is another example. There's a song called The Island by The Decemberists that's super long, but it's in like 3 distinct movements, and that's fine. I get that. But when it comes to most songs I hear, the producers are just idiots. So if you're in a band, call me. I'll totally set you straight.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, everybody, that is our show. Thanks for listening. I'm going to be continuing this series on what the church needs to do to engage our culture. If you've got ideas about things that you think need to be addressed under this banner, then give me a call. As I said at the beginning of the show, the number is 949-354-2483. Let me know if there's something that you think that I perhaps have missed, that I need to address, and I will absolutely listen because I am all ears. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. Later.